Good afternoon and good evening, and welcome to our third class, our third conversation on Spirit, Love, and You. Those of you who've been here for a while have been listening to Shamdas singing Sweet Radhe. It's a song from one of his albums, and I played it not only because I happen to love Shamdas and because it's a really quite a beautiful example of a certain kind of devotional singing, the hardcore kirtan singing of the Vaishnava tradition of India, where devotees got together, as so many of you know, and sang and clapped and howled sometimes the names of God, especially the names of Krishna and his beloved Radha. And also I played this because Shamdas died a couple of days ago, and it was really in his honor. He was a being who could very deeply invoke the well of bhakti. The tradition of bhakti, the Indian tradition of bhakti, of which Shamdas was such a great exemplar and practitioner, was like mystical Christianity and Sufism in that it made simple, heartfelt love the center of spiritual practice and the center of religion. Swami Vivekananda, who was one of the great Indian spiritual intellectuals to come to the United States at the end of the 19th century, he wrote a really beautiful book. Actually, it's a series of lectures on the yoga of devotion. One of the things that he points out is that the yoga of the heart, devotional yoga, is the heart of most of the popular religious practice in the traditions all over the world. And as he points out, the downside of the devotional path is that they can tend to fanaticism. We know about that. But the beautiful side of it, the exquisite side of it, is that it actually, the path of devotion, the path of love, makes spirit accessible to people in every state, in every country, in every class. And the Krishna Bhaktas of India, very much like the lovers of the Holy Mother Mary and Jesus in Latin America and in Europe, the Krishna Bhaktas of India come from every class and every caste. Many of them were poor, oppressed, cobblers and laborers, and people whose lives were incredibly difficult, who often they were outcasts. And many of them were poets who wrote songs about their feelings, including their frustration and pain. And these songs, which we still sing today, have the power of a very, very deep lineage of heart besotted beings who are able to keep love in their hearts even during very, very hard times, really because of the power that they were able to locate through their devotion to God in the second person, God as a being, as an other, which inevitably, invariably led them to the recognition of the divine in their own hearts. So we're going to speak some more tonight about the personal face of devotion. We've been practicing the last couple of days with meditation on the beloved, where we call the beloved inwardly and imagine the beloved as both an external presence and as an inner felt state. Some of you have been sharing some pretty dramatic and exquisite dreams. Some of you have been very deeply finding the beloved as your own self. And my sense is that, as with everything else in the journey of the heart, the journey of spirit, each of us has a unique experience of these practices. Some of the meditations that we've done this week have been mind-blowing for some of you, and some of you have sort of gone, oh, well, not that one. And in the same way, a lot of you have shared that the contemplation on love is fitting very easily and very beautifully into your daytime relationships. And some of you have been finding that actually it's been impacting your daytime relationships in a kind of frustrating or oppositional ways, which is, of course, also one of the powers of the love path. It's the path in which whatever's in the heart, even things that have been very deeply buried, get pulled out of the heart, churned out of the heart, and often mirrored back to you through the people in your life. So it's an enormously rich and protean and beautiful cauldron, really, that we've leapt into together during these 3 weeks and during the week to come. Because, of course, the week to come is really, in a sense, the culmination of everything that we've been talking about and practicing and doing together in these 2 weeks. There's a beautiful statement by Rumi, who, of course, is the kind of ultimate teacher of the path of love, the path of non-dual love, the path of total devotional love for a single beloved, and the path in which we recognize love as the all. He writes, "Earth love, spirit love, any love, looks into that yonder, that vastness. And whatever I try to say, explaining love is embarrassing. Some commentary clarifies," Rumi says, "but with love, silence is clearer. If you want to expound on love, take your intellect out and let it lie down in the mud. It's no help. So let's begin by allowing our intellect to lie down in the mud, as it were, the mud of the heart, the mud of the deep core primal feelings that are the source of love. In the rag and bone shop of the heart, as the poet Yeats wrote. And from that place, we'll chant the non-dual mantras that invoke the Absolute as Shiva, the one who exists as the foundational consciousness of all that is, whose nature is pure being, pure awareness, and unbroken joy, who is our self, and who also is our teacher and guide. Then we'll offer our practice for the benefit of all beings, and then we'll get into our first meditation for the evening. So please find a posture, comfortable, upright, one where your sitting bones, your hips and thighs are grounded, where your torso is lifting upward, yet not rigidly upright, and your shoulder blades are releasing down the back. Be aware of the flow of the breath in your nostrils. Sense the movement of the breath in the different parts of your body, perhaps in the chest or the abdomen or the shoulders. Tune in a little bit deeper and see if you can feel the rhythm of the pulse, the heartbeat. And let your attention flow through the body so that you feel the way the muscles are holding you in place. You sense the touch of the air against your face and your skin. Your eyes are closed, unless you need to open them to read your mantras. Your tongue is soft on the floor of your mouth. Your awareness touches the heart. And we chant.
Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambhaya Tirthe.
power of our practice, all beings may have happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask to know the equanimity that is free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. And we ask to know the equality of all that is. With your attention in the breath, allow the inhalation and exhalation to draw you into the heart, noticing the feeling state of your heart, not with any judgment or grasping, just noticing how your heart feels right now. Maybe thoughts are coming and going. Maybe there's a softness or a quiet. Maybe you feel a little bit agitated. Maybe it's been a hard week. Let the breath touch your heart with its ever-present caress. And as the breath flows in, have the thought, the subtle wish, may I be held in love. And with the exhalation, may love embrace me. Inhaling, may I be held in love. Exhale, may love embrace me. Have this sense that your heart opens like the shutter of a camera. And as it does, the feeling of tenderness, acceptance, lovingness flows in and out through the heart with the breath. And your inhalation, may I be held in love. Your exhalation, may love embrace me. And you can expand that wish to include someone whom you would like to include in the field of love. May that person be held in love. May love embrace her. perhaps you'd like to widen the prayer with the thought, may all those whose lives my life touches be held in love. May love embrace all those whose lives my life touches. And then may I be held in love. May love embrace me. I want to read another poem of Rumi's, which is really, in a certain sense, the core teaching about the path of love. In the Bhakti Sutras and in most of the texts about the path of meditation, there is a statement that's kind of the core of the recognition that we come to have about the object of our attention and our love. And that teaching, which we'll come back to again, is we become what we love. We become what we focus on. We become what we think about. And this very, very subtle mystical truth, which I know for myself I've come back to again and again at many, many levels over the years, always with that feeling of knowing the place for the first time. That truth is really the gift of the path of love, the devotional path. It's that ultimately when we love, when we recognize that it's spirit that loves through us, that it's love itself that loves through us, eventually over time, our mind, our consciousness gets cooked, gets pickled in that recognition, and love begins to shine through our actions and our words, and more subtly through our energy field. So here's what Rumi has to say about the incredible intoxication of love, of infatuation, of the powerful erotic impulse, which is the very breath of life, the very cause of life. He says, God has given us a dark wine so potent that drinking it, we leave the two worlds. God has put into the form of hashish a power to deliver the taster from self-consciousness. God has made sleep so that it erases every thought. God made Majnu, the legendary lover of Sufism, love Laila so much that just her dog would cause confusion in him. There are thousands of wines that can take over our minds. Don't think all ecstasies are the same. Jesus was lost in his love for God. His donkey was drunk with barley. Drink from the presence of saints, not from those other jars. Every object, every being is a jar full of delight. Be a connoisseur and taste with caution. Any wine will get you high. So judge like a king and choose the purest, the ones unadulterated with fear or some urgency about what's needed. Drink the wine that moves you as a camel moves when it's been untied and is just ambling about. So one of the teachings, one of the truths that the great beings like Rumi offer us is not that we should only love holy beings or holy people or the formless divine, but that we should let our love take us towards freedom, that we should love that which gets us high, and learn how to give up the attachment that binds us. And of course, that's the journey. That's the journey. Because it is the nature of human love, of the human psyche, the human consciousness, to naturally become attached to what gives us even a glimpse of ecstasy, and to become afraid of losing it. So, as we move further into the discussion of spirit, love, and you, I want to talk for just a moment about the basic intellectual construct that started to come up last week, and several people mentioned it, because there are certain constructs, certain intellectual constructs that are actually clarifying. And one of them, one of the ones that has really been clarifying for me is the conversation about the fact that there are always three faces and three perspectives in love. And that whichever one of these faces we may be experiencing, it's always a portal into the higher love, the ecstatic love. You know, our way of experiencing love may be really different than what our teachers say or what the other people in our excuse me, in our spiritual study group say or what Rumi says, because every piece of teaching on love looks at it from a particular perspective and uncovers a particular facet. If you think of love as being like a diamond or like a crystal that has so many facets, so there's the facet of love that's compassionate, that's, you know, certain traditions really, we could say, privilege love as compassion. And there are faces of love that look ecstatic and romantic, and there are definitely traditions. I have to be prejudiced towards those traditions. I must say that privilege love as ecstatic. And there are traditions, there's a kind of love that's a kind of a wise, all-embracing, spacious recognition that whatever arises and subsides in the inner and outer world is held in love. And any and all of these ways of approaching love and all the others, you know, the love of the motherly love that wants to nourish and protect others as a child, the fatherly love that wants to teach and protect, the teacherly love, the guru's love that, you know, sometimes shows love by holding up a mirror to everything in you that's unlove. All these facets of love are part of the diamond that unfolds in us. And at any moment we may be experiencing one or another face, the important thing is to realize that when the face of love is showing us also, along with love, a facet of freedom, facet of our freedom, then we can trust it. We can trust that what we're seeing is a face of the great love, the big love. So, you know, just because not everybody, I think, in this class is familiar with this particular paradigm, the idea of love as having three faces, I just want to say that it's actually a paradigm, you know, the law of three, that pretty much exists in every tradition. Ken Wilber, who's the originator of that actual phrase, the three faces of love, calls these perspectives. And they're the perspectives of first, second, and third person, or to use the language of the Eastern traditions, the seer, who is you, me, our subjective seeing, the seen, which is anything that we experience as an other, and the process of seeing, which connects them. And these I'm going to briefly define each of them in terms of first, second, and third person, just so that we're clear about it. Not because the frameworks are the be-all and end-all, but because they're just helpful in this conversation. So the third-person perspective is the recognition that the world has an independent existence outside of you. And third-person can be experienced in many different ways. So, for example, at a certain level of consciousness, the physical objects and natural forces around you can seem like fixed, unchanging, very dense realities. In fact, we tend to call them reality, subject to scientific laws, and in certain ways, insentient. So the world as a physical reality, even when we know that it's changing and impermanent, can seem very, very thick and dense and unchanging. And we may literally fall in love in an extremely attached way to certain aspects of the physical world, such as our house or our iPod or a tree or a landscape. But much of the time, even when we are loving it, even when we're attached to what we think of as objective reality, we often don't relate to it as living or as capable of emotion or as able to love us back, so to speak. So in other words, when you love your computer, you don't experience it as the same thing as loving another human being because you don't necessarily believe that your computer can love you back. But as your vision begins to awaken, maybe through a Kundalini awakening or one of those semi-miraculous shifts of perspective that, you know, in which we suddenly get that everything is not the way we thought it was, or maybe through just being in love or a spontaneous seeing, we realize that even the apparently insentient is actually alive. One of the great kind of realizations of the miraculous nature of the world used to come to me back in the day when I used a lot of huge industrial Xerox machines and not being very intelligent about machines. They often would give me a hard time. I wouldn't be able to get them to start. I wouldn't be able to find out how to change the paper. You know how it is if you've ever used a corporate Xerox machine, copier, as they're called these days. And what I discovered one day, and this was a long time ago, it was at the very beginning of my spiritual journey, I was working with a particularly recalcitrant Xerox copier, and very angry at it and very impatient and frustrated, as I often was in relating to the physical world, when suddenly I looked down at the piece of paper I was trying to copy, which happened to be a line from Kashmir Shaivism, a sutra from a text called the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, the doctrine of the heart of self-recognition. And it said, the line said, universal consciousness upon its own screen in absolute freedom manifests this universe. And in that moment, an intuition arose that, oh, the Xerox copier was also manifested by universal consciousness. And in that moment, almost as if the copier had heard my thought, it suddenly started copying. This stuck Xerox machine began to whir and hum and made 136 copies of this sheet of paper I'd been desperately trying to get to copy. And in that moment, I realized that even the so-called insentient world of machines, of, so to speak, man-made objects of plastic, is sentient, is somehow connected as consciousness. It's not so hard to see third-person spirit, to see the love, the universal love in a tree or in a natural landscape. But as Jane Hirschfield, the California poet, writes, the blown field of a yellow curtain might also, as it floods and falls, ruin your heart. Have you ever fallen in love with a curtain blowing in the wind? Or the blue light glowing from your external hard drive? So anything can catch the heart off guard and blow it open. Because love, what my guru called the love flow of God manifest, is totally present in everything. So, of course, from the highest perspective, from the ultimate perspective, love in third person, love as the manifest world, is actually the evolutionary force that, in Dante's famous phrase, moves the sun and the stars. It's the ultimate force of divine eros. It's evolution. It's the miraculous urgency that makes molecules join to make cells and unicellular creatures join to make multicellular ones. And to me, one of the great discoveries has been to realize that love is also, third-person love is also appearing as innovation, as the beauty we see in a staircase or a bookshelf. And as the force of grace that acts through the mind and body to heal, transform, that grows new neuronal pathways in the brain to replace the ones that don't work any longer because you had a stroke or a head injury. And third-person love is the power that arises in the lives of you and I and turns our life in a new direction. So love in third person is kundalini, is shakti, is spirit, is everything. A force so vast that it's hard to even grasp it unless love itself wants to show you that it's all there is. So I bring this up actually partly so that I can read the beautiful poem that Sis sent us about how the love we are is the love that is everything. And maybe you read it on the listserv, but here it is. What love am I? What love am I? I am the hawk. I am the sparrow. What love am I? What love am I? I am the sword. I am the wound. What love am I? What love am I? Om. 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 So one of the great practices of tuning into love in the third person, love as the massive power of consciousness, is simply to look around and name whatever you see and feel, whatever comes into your awareness as love. This was one of my guru's favorite practices. And he used to say, this is the best meditation. Just name whatever you see as love, and we'll do it now. You can close your eyes if you like and be aware of the sensations in your body. Name them, whatever it is, the gurgle in your stomach, the little pain underneath your shoulder blades, the touch of the breath, name it as love. Name the breath love. Name the floor that you feel beneath you as love. Name the air love. Name your headset or your speakerphone love. Name the virtual reality that we share love. Name your body love. Name my voice love. Open your eyes and look around and name what you see, love. And if love doesn't do it for you, find a word that does. Maybe the word is spirit. Maybe it's God. Maybe it's consciousness, energy. Now, the extraordinary thing about this particular meditation is that when you find the right word, and sometimes it's a different word on different days, today it might be love, tomorrow it might be divine intelligence or truth. When you find the right word, the word that actually plugs you into the felt sense of spirit, especially spirit as love. Perhaps it's self. This is myself. That is myself. What you notice is that that thought transforms, it transmutes the density of the world around you and also of your own less exalted thoughts. It's literally love's alchemy to just have that thought, and it's part of the process of transforming ourselves by what we focus on. So, just as the actual naming of the world as love begins to soften our relationships with the physical world, in the same way, when we begin to name the beings in our life as love, that begins to open us up to the secret inside what Ken calls second person love, or second person spirit, which is, of course, the form of love that most of us spend our lives trying to figure out. Of course, we're born, if we're lucky, out of a second person love encounter between our parents, and we grow towards love through and in our relationships. And with luck, we'll actually catch glimpses of the immortal beloved in our lovers and our children and our friends and our pets. And of course, sometimes we won't. But how it's meant to be, as I know we all know, it's one of the things that we all know. Our relationships are supposed to be the school in which we discover divine love. And, you know, I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember the book that started all this. It was a popular book that came out about near-death experiences. I think it was really the first of the series of books that have come out periodically from people who came close to death. And this is a series of interviews that a researcher did with people who had almost died, who'd been in accidents or died on the operating table. And over again, these people talked about coming face-to-face with a light or a guide. And in so many cases, what they heard from within the light or in the voice of the guide was this question: have you learned to love? And I can remember that question, you know, reading this and being going, wow, you mean it's all about that? It's not about, you know, getting my life together or, you know, actually learning how to finish an article or a book or, you know, any of the things that I thought it was about, that life is really at its core a school for love, for learning to love. Now, in the Bhakti tradition and the Sufi tradition and the other mystical devotional traditions, take the position that all our human forms of love are, in a sense, a rehearsal for recognizing the source of love, which is, of course, God. And in the non-dual traditions, what we are taught, what we learn, and what we experience is that the source of love, divine love, whether it's the love of a deity or some form of the absolute, that the source of it is within us, and we'll get to that in a moment. But the truth is that since love is really non-dual, our personal relationships are not rehearsals or substitutes for the ultimate love. The source of love is not just in our heart. It's not just the Divine Mother. We are actually loving spirit by loving another person. And when another person loves us, no matter how fucked up their way of loving us may be, it is spirit loving us through that person. But I think the beautiful thing about second person love, love of the beloved other, whether it's an actual human being or a divine beloved, an inner beloved, the being that comes in dreams like the ones that some of you shared this week, is that it's so very personal. You know, we love the individuality of the beloved, the eyelashes of the beloved, the sound of her voice, the way she looks when she's asleep, certain ways that the beloved smiles, and also that tremendous feeling of both familiarity and strangeness that can come to us with a person who's really knocked open the door of our heart. We love the beloved's vulnerability, which is a big deal. And, of course, it goes without saying that when we're in the school of love, of second-person love, then the people are often not only the arena for love, but they're also the arena for all of our dissatisfaction, our judgment, our blame, our losses, all the stuff of karmic love. everything that happens to the great love when it's filtered through desire and frustration. And, you know, the whole nature of human love, second person love, is that somehow we so often seem to get the timing wrong. So when we're ready for the deepest intimacy, the other person wants to watch TV, or maybe they've fallen in love with somebody else, or when we want to share revelation, we find their wet towel on the chair, and instead of sharing insight, we just want to scream at him. So the second person relationship, and that includes the relationship with the divine, if we're really honest about it, is both a school through which we taste personal love in all its sweetness, but also the cauldron in which our gnarly reactive emotions get brought out and transmuted. And in one sense, what I've often felt, because a lot of my own life, like your lives, has been about falling in love with someone or something on the outside and then being brought through frustration or separation, or the fact that the person I'd fallen in love with was my guru and wasn't going to, you know, get together with me in any satisfying personal way. It always felt as though the second person love, the love of the other, was involved in a conspiracy to bring me back to the recognition of being loved as an inner experience. I shared this on the listserv, and maybe it's one of those experiences that doesn't translate, but I'm going to tell you anyway because it was a huge moment for me. And it was during a time in my life when I had gotten a serious crush on another person, and it was kind of an impossible crush because of the life situation that I was in, not something that I ever had considered acting on, but which was causing me both enormous sweetness and enormous heartbreak. And one day I was sitting in meditation, and I was feeling this love, which had a very devotional quality to it, and was full of the, you know, the feeling of wanting to serve and help this person, and all of a sudden, the direction of my love, the feeling of my love, kind of shifted in a radical and dramatic way, and I became aware that love was being poured into me through the top of my head, and it felt very much as though it were being poured into me by a personal form of the divine. I actually said to myself, who is this? Where is this coming from? You know, is this Shiva? Is this the divine mother? Whose love is this? And as I kept asking that question, the direction of the feeling, and we're talking here about, you know, absolute romantic ecstasy, the wine of devotion, it, instead of coming in from outside, it was welling up from inside my heart. It was like the wellspring of inner love, the wellspring of the love that you know without question is the love of the self, the love of God living as you, of love living as you. And it was as though I'd been taught through experience that all loves lead to the self. That is, that in the end, the love you have for another person, the love you feel for the universe, the love you feel for a personal deity, it's going to awaken in you the recognition, as so many people have shared, that love is you, that you are love, that you are the source of all of it. And, you know, and in this way, we come to this recognition, and what I would like to emphasize is that even though it may be the ultimate to recognize I am love or all this is love, but I believe that what we really want as God in human form is to experience all of it. Yes, for sure, some forms of love, some of the faces of love are sweeter than others, and some of the faces of love are easier for us than others. Some of the faces of love are more heartbreaking, and some of us like heartbreak. But for myself, and I think that this is the position of Rumi and certainly the position of my guru, I think what we want is all of it. We want to feel intimate personal love for another human being whom we get to know, whether as a friend or as a lover or as a child or as a teacher or as a protector. But we want actual personal intimacy with somebody who has skin, you know, who sees us through their eyes. And we want, at least I'll speak for myself, an intimate personal relationship with the divine as a personal being, as a higher power, if you will, as a divine mother, lover, father, teacher whom we can go to for help and protection, for refuge, who will teach us, who will pour divine energy into us when we need it. And of course, we want the powerful independence and freedom and self-sufficiency of knowing that I, that you, contain within yourself every possible form of love, and that all love eventually comes down to the overflowing wellspring in the heart. So to do the sadhana of love, to live your life as if you were in a school of love, demands that we don't deny any form of love, and that includes the hard parts, the hard forms. You know, in the advanced class, you know, the advanced class of beings like St. Francis and many, many people that I know in this world, we don't deny that love with any living being. So we're willing to open to love with even people for whom we have an aversion or of whom we're afraid. And of course, we don't act out all forms of love, because some forms of love are just too hot or too inappropriate or create too much karma. But we do want to recognize the gifts that love is always giving us, both in the very subtle aspects of love and in all the ways that love urgently desires to break you open and fill you up with itself. So, with your awareness in the breath, you can let your body come into an upright posture. And if you're lying down, which is also okay, let your back be straight but not rigid. And let your heart open like the shutter of a camera, the shutter of a camera. Or if you like, you can do the gesture that Hanuman makes when he uses his hands to pull open his heart. Many of you, if you know the mythology of Hinduism, you know that story where the monkey god Hanuman, who is a devotee of God as Lord Rama, is asked, where is God? And he pulls open his chest and shows God sitting in his heart. So you can, this is actually a beautiful gesture to kind of coax your heart to open. Is just imagine that with your hands, you're opening the door of your heart. And begin to feel love flowing towards you into the heart. Feel that love is mothering you. That love wants to give you the nurturance that maybe your personal mother didn't give you, or maybe she did. Let yourself open to love as the divine mother energy that flows gently into you through the heart. In this moment, see if you can accept, if only for a moment or if only provisionally, that love mothers you completely, that love holds you. There's no giving necessary. You only have to receive. So with the feeling that your heart is open, draw in the soft feminine, the holding feminine. Now, in this process of receiving love, there's another mode in which love breaks us open. If the gentle face of love is its healing, holding presence, the forceful face of love is equally powerful and equally necessary as the urgency that allows love to sweep away all the karmic barriers and the walls that keep us from fully being the love that we are. And this is what has traditionally been called the masculine face of love. I don't believe that either of these forms, the gentle and the strong, are either masculine or feminine. But let's think of this as the masculine face of love, the Father God, the Father, Lover, God, face of love. Imagine now that the divine force, the force of the universal Eros, wants to penetrate the walls of your individuality, wants to break open the barriers that you might have put up to love. And it's not going to do this softly, because some of these barriers actually need to be broken through. And as I was thinking about this face of love, I remembered a poem by the great 17th century poet John Donne, who wrote two kinds of poems. He wrote about passionate human love with his wife, and he wrote about divine love, passionate divine love. And he describes this face of love in one of his most famous poems. I want to read it to you, and I want to ask you to listen to it as if it were your own plea, your own request, your own yearning to have your walls broken down. He says, "Batter my heart, three-personed God." God in all three faces. "Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet, but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend. So hear what he's saying, the gentle subtlety of love, which knocks on the door of the heart, which breathes into us, which shines on us, which heals, is sometimes not enough to open us. There are parts of us that respond to nurturing and parts that have to be forced open. These walls, these egoic barriers, these fences around your heart, our doubts, our our sense that our belief that everything else is more important than love. So the subtle presence of the divine moving through our breath or shining through the rays of sunlight or filling us with peace and meditation is not enough to create this radical opening. And so Donne, the great religious poet, writes, "Batter my heart, three-personed God, that I may rise and stand, overthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new." Bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like a captured town to another due, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. I'm trying to let you in, but it's not working. Dearly I love you and would be loved by you, but I am betrothed to your enemy. Divorce me from that one. Untie or break that knot again. And then he cries out, "Take me to you. Imprison me. For I, unless you enthrall me, never shall be free." Unless you enthrall me, I never shall be free, nor ever chaste unless you ravish me. So now in your own way, invite that forceful presence of the divine to ravish your heart. Have the feeling that you're being ravished by the overwhelming power of divine love. With its full force, it's breaking open any walls around your heart. But imagine that the divine power loves you like a lover. Imagine the urgency of the most powerful erotic longing you've ever experienced. And imagine that this longing fills God's heart, but in an absolute way. And this longing, this absolute longing to become one with you, is the longing that love feels for you. So ask the force of love, who wants you, who desires you, who is unwilling to let you float on in your undirected, unloved, separated path, that path that we've all been on for lifetimes. Ask the force of love to break open your heart, not in anger, not to hurt you, but to take down the walls. See if you can feel how the divine wants to ravish you, to ravish you open to love, and let it happen. Just imagine that you're being ravished open to love. Notice what the experience is of looking at love as the ravisher, as the heart ravisher, as the divine masculine force whose only goal is to break you open, so open that the whole universe can live in your heart. There'll be times when to open to love is the gentle face of the feminine. It's what we need in order to be present to the love that wants to hold us. And there'll be times when we really need the strength and forcefulness of the divine battering ram. Or when the image of being ravished open to God, ravished open to the universe, is really powerful, is really transformative. And what I'd like to encourage you to do during the week to come, and hopefully for the rest of your life, is to try on the different flavors and faces of love, to notice which face of love is the one that is going to open you the most fully in any given moment. And recognize that it just doesn't always look the way you think it's going to look. It isn't always cool. And it isn't always easy. And it isn't always safe. And it isn't always available. You know, being humans, there are going to be times when we call on love and it doesn't seem to be there. And, of course, the Sufi poets are famous for spending long nights calling out for sacred intimacy and feeling that their calls were unheard. And it's for that reason, I believe, that the poet Kabir wrote in, I think, one of the most powerful pieces of wisdom that any poet of love has ever offered us. Kabir wrote, "God is in your longing. And in illustration of that, I want to tell you a story from a very beautiful book that I read a few months ago by a writer and wilderness guide whom some of you may know, named Treby Johnson. It's called The World is a Waiting Lover, which is, I think, a great title. And, excuse me, I want to say she's not a non-dualist. This is not a book about merging into the absolute. It's a very human story with a kind of a Jungian twist. But she does describe very beautifully how our human affections, even our human infatuations, can, under the right circumstances and with the right motivation, let's say, be the really the catalyst for the deepest inner journey. So her story begins, she starts with an experience that she had after a wilderness trip. She was working as a guide, and she was working with a younger man who was her kind of apprentice. And at one point in the trip, he told her that he loved her, and for some reason this triggered an enormous infatuation in her, and she fell totally in love with him. She was married. She had no idea what to do with the infatuation, but she couldn't let it go. It completely obsessed her. If you've ever had one of those infatuations, you know how it feels. And finally, she decided that she would call him and tell him about it. This is months later. She called him, and he made it completely clear to her that it was not reciprocated, that he liked her very much. He'd had a deep connection with her on this trip, but he was not, even remotely interested in having a love affair with her. So what that meant was that she had the choice either of kind of letting her heart break and putting a wall over it, or following the feeling into a deeper place. And she decided that she would use her wisdom to look into the nature of the feeling. She actually shared it with her husband and began to journal about it. And of course, what she discovered, as we will do if we really follow second person love in a very true way, she realized that it wasn't about the man, that the man she fell in love with had been the face of the great love, the external face of the great love, but not himself, the beloved. Rather, and this is her phrase, he had been an escort to the beloved for her. And I think that that's a very powerful idea. If you can realize who in your life, the people in your life, who have been for you escorts to the inner beloved, to the great love, it really helps you not only put your life into perspective, your loving life into perspective, but also gives you a whole different sense of your journey. So from that place, from that experience, she does a rumination on devotional love. Starting with the Song of Solomon, which, the beautiful erotic poetry of the Song of Songs, where, the poet sings, "I am the beloved and the beloved is mine," and writes very, very deeply about erotic love as a love for the divine that's a complete all body, all mind, powerful, powerful way of taking the personal and the impersonal into a deeper place. So essentially what this kind of experience points us to is how our longing for human love, our satisfaction and our dissatisfaction in human love, if we keep turning it towards the inner beloved, whatever shape and form that takes, it will become a portal into the love that's always waiting for us. And the truth is that the more passionate our longing is, as we know, the greater the chance it has of breaking open the heart. So infatuation and unrequited love, when they happen to us, are, from this point of view, kind of a gift. And one of the deep truths that we start to recognize, this brings me back to what I was saying in the beginning, is that when we really look at the loves in our life as portals to the great love, as expressions of the great love, not to deny their significance or their value in themselves, but always to remind us of what it is that we really love. You know, there's a basic truth. It's a joke that people start to look like their dogs, or that married couples start to look like each other, or that children take on the characteristics of their parents. You know, I look in the mirror sometimes and I see the same expression on my face that I used to see on my mother's face. It's terrifying. But it's just a fact that we do take on the characteristics of the people that we love. Just as young writers or artists will often go through a phase when they're writing in the style of the teachers they admire. And it happens in good ways and bad ways. You know, when we obsess about someone or something, we can sometimes lose our individuality or our identity in our identification with or our infatuation with another. But when we're looking at our call towards another person or towards an artist or even towards a deity as a portal into spirit, then you realize that you can use this tendency of the heart to merge into whatever we seek to make our own. So if it's really true that we become what we love, then when we have the wisdom to look for spirit in whatever we love, then our love, whether it's for a person or for our calling or for the world itself or for a deity, will eventually transmute your mind, your personal mind, into a divine mind, into a mind saturated with love or into spirit. And you will realize that not only is the beloved within you, not only are you love, but that you are actually swimming in a sea of spirit as love. Carl Jung, who had so much intuition into the way consciousness worked and so often stumbled on the truths that the great mystics discovered for themselves through their contemplation, he was once trying to deal with a patient who'd fallen in love with him, as patients do with therapists, and as students do with their teachers. And this patient was looked on him as a kind of divine father lover. She literally saw him as a god, in much the way some of us may have, I certainly did, seen our, you know, worshipped our guru as divine, or sometimes even worshipped a lover as divine, but it happens a lot with teachers and mentors. So Jung, as was his very insightful understanding, wanted to help her take back the projection, wanted to help her recognize that what she saw in him was actually her own divinity, and to recognize, you know, that the one she loved was her. But as he considered her situation, he also began to think about some of the great devotional poets and writers, and the one he thought of was one of the ecstatic medieval lovers of Jesus, Mechtilde of Magdeburg, who described feeling a force of longing inside her, that in her words, she described it as my soul roaring with the force of a hungry lion. And to Jung, this recognition, because Jung does not appear to have been a person who was moved by passion, but in his recognition of the passion that he saw in his patient and the passion of this mystic, he saw that they weren't different. And he realized that this worshipful love for an idealized other, whether it's a mentor or a parent or, you know, a lover, is related to a force that runs through human beings through the ages and is actually one of the powerful factors in personal transformation. You know, that is, we become what we love. And the more we love it, the more the force of love itself is going to transform us. He wrote, could the longing for a God be a passion welling up from our darkest instinctual nature, a passion unswayed by any outside influences, deeper and stronger, perhaps, than the love for a human person? Well, in a certain sense, you might say, duh, because most of you at least have read the mystical poets and maybe even known some and maybe even be one yourself. But what he intuited, what Jung intuited, was something that has been hard for modern people to realize, which is that the passion for sacred intimacy is one of the deepest urges in the human soul, and that it's that passion for sacred intimacy, that drive for intimacy, makes us seek for another person with whom to share it. But really, it can't be satisfied except by the great love. And when we recognize that desire for love for what it is and bring it inside, it can take us, and I'm using Jung's words, to the most immediate experiences of the divine that it is possible to imagine. And he goes on to say that to carry a God within yourself is almost the same thing as being a God. So the fact is, of course, that if you're someone who has tapped into the truth of mystical love, you will realize that it's not just that to carry a God within yourself is almost the same thing as being a God. It's that when we follow the path of love with real devotion, and here I mean devotion to love. It doesn't have to be devotion to a particular person. But the devotion to love, like the devotion to truth, is the path that allows us to transform all the unlove that we've held in our being due to our karmic experience over lifetimes and show us that what we are is love. So whether we find that longing through a person or a place or a deity or a teacher or as the inner lover, the father, the inner mother that so many of you are discovering, really the beloved is going to reveal to you that you are love, your nature is love, and that you do indeed have a capacity to live as love. Not just to become more loving, but to live as love. In the mystical traditions, the culmination of the journey of love is sometimes called union, or by the Sufis, fana, the dying of the individual separate self. But the thing that the greatest mystics of love know is that even after dissolving into love, there's a new birth, because the end of the path of love isn't dissolution. It's the coming together of lover, beloved, and love itself to create what the deepest mystics have described as an integrated love body within us. So the love that we've cultivated and that we've followed becomes a body of love. And that means we can love others without losing our center. We can recognize our own absolute divinity without arrogance or inflation. We can walk through the world with the recognition that the world is our lover without ever touching the world in a way that can do anything but bring it greater freedom. In In the Bhakti Sutras, the state of fully integrated love is called ananyata, which means non-otherness, non-duality. And it's just about realizing that everything you love, everything you're drawn to, everything you're attracted to, is attracting you to the divine. So that there's no neediness in love. It's just lovingness. Your sensual pleasure is pleasure in the divine experience through the senses. Your pain is God's pain for the world. Your actions are their expression of God's power of action. And all of your questions about what you should be doing are answered by the awareness that what you're here to do is love. So I'd like to, as we bring this conversation to a close, we are beginning a week of practice, and one of our practices this week will be just that, just dedicating yourself to recognizing that what you're here to do is love, be loved. Whatever that looks like in any given moment, what you're here to do is let your heart be softened, broken open, and turned towards love from within, from outside. Love that you can find inside yourself if it's not coming to you from another person. And then maybe offer to another person just because you're feeling it inside. And I also want to remind you that next month we're going to be exploring the path of the divine powers, the Shaktis, that express themselves as the feminine forces of the Indian tradition. These Shaktis are really the powers behind transformation in our journey of awakening, and this class is going to focus specifically on the forms of the divine feminine that acts as guides and protectors and awakeners on the inner journey. So this is about the goddess as the force that breaks you open, that loves you into the fully awake state. And the class is based on my new book, which has a really long title, Awakening Shaktis, The Transformative Power of the Goddesses of Yoga. And I just found out that the book is actually going to be, its publication date was February 1st, but turns out it's available from Amazon on Friday, the 25th. So I just wanted to tell you about that, partly because I'm really excited about it, and partly because I hope you'll order it and read it. It's available both in print and on Kindle, but I really recommend the print version because it has gorgeous illustrations, really exquisite line drawing illustrations that are filled with Shakti, really with the Shakti of the lineage of the artist. And they're designed to be used as meditation aids, as yantras for meditation. So have a beautiful week. You'll be getting a homework assignment. Let's please continue the conversation on the listserv. And I hope you'll live this week and always dancing in and out of the recognition that no matter how we feel at any given moment, it really is love that's living as you, as me, as everything in your life. And as we close, perhaps we can just spend a moment, and after the call is done, I encourage you to sit with this awareness that your heart just gently opens like the shutter of a camera. and allows love to gently seep into your heart with the inhalation and flow through your body with the exhalation. So this is the love that heals, that mends, that shines, that breathes. The love of the soft mother. The love that breathes us. Have a beautiful night, a beautiful week. Namaste.